Hello and welcome. It has taken us 20 full episodes, but we have now covered a full 2.5 millennia of Iranian history. And guess what? We have at least another 2,500 years left to go. But don't worry, as promised, today we will end our Iranian adventure. So I will do this in one single episode. But I have to warn you, this will be time tourism Japanese style. Breakfast in Paris, lunch in Berlin, tea in London, and back home by evening. Fasten your seatbelts, because here goes. Iranian settled civilization is about as old as any other on the planet. I suppose you are familiar with the so-called cradle of civilization, right? Where you have those famous first big towns? Well, that early in the game, in what is now Western Iran, there already emerged the city-state of Susa. Some put its beginnings in the 4th millennium BCE, some put it even earlier than that. The people of that region are commonly referred to as the Elamites, but there is much controversy about what that even means. Part of the problem is that the Elamites left few sources, and that their ancient script has not yet been deciphered. So researchers are dependent on information from their Mesopotamian rivals. Something that Iranians would have to get used to, for that fate will befall some of their later empires too. The first time that the word Elam appears is when in the 3rd millennium BCE, the Sumerians claim to have conquered a people by that name. It's likely that this was not unified empire though, but rather a collection of peoples centered on a number of city-states, and that did not consider themselves as one. Elam might well have been an invention by outsiders, so. Not that unusual, you'll no doubt recall that the term Arab has very similar roots. What is clear, however, is that already in this early period, two places in Elam were of particular importance. On the one hand, you had Susa, strategically located in the eastern edge of Mesopotamia, next to the Karun River, the only stream in Iran that can be traveled by boat throughout the year. The other region of importance was Anshan, in the fertile highland region that is known as Fars or Pars. That is where the word Persia comes from. This would be the home region of both Cyrus the Great and of the Sasanians. Now, Anshan was often disregarded by the Mesopotamians as it was far out of their orbit. They tended to equate Elam with the region around Susa or Susiana, and consequently, so did many later historians, since these Mesopotamians provide much of the source material that they can access. Recently, though, it has emerged that for most of history, Anshan was the more important part. Susiana was subjugated to Mesopotamian states like Ur or Akkad for much of its history, while Anshan, protected by the natural mountain fortress that is Iran, usually managed to remain independent. This new insight casts the history of Elam into a new light. Anshan and Susiana were two distinct regions in nearly every sense, not so surprising given their very different natural environments. Susiana was close to Mesopotamia, and it would be heavily influenced by the cultures there, especially in the periods when it was politically dominated by their western neighbors. But for other long periods, it would be part of the same political entity as Anshan. Even then, they retained their separate identity. Tellingly, rulers would even call themselves King of Anshan and Susa. Still, during these long periods of political unification, Susa would also absorb much of the culture of Anshan. This process began, slowly, in the 2nd millennium BCE, after the Elamites first allied with the people of Susa to bring down their erstwhile oppressors, the Mesopotamian kings of the 3rd dynasty of Ur. In the first part of the 2nd millennium, the Elamites were perhaps the greatest power in the whole region, and hence in the world. Much like today, they determined the fate of kings as far away as Syria, and even the king of Babylon would refer to the Elamite ruler as father, implying of course that he was more than an equal. Later in that millennium, this history would repeat itself, with Elam first dominated by South Mesopotamia once again, only to break free again and sack Babylon. The Elamite king then even put his own son on the Babylonian throne. This event explains why such famous Mesopotamian items as the Code of Hammurabi were in fact excavated in Iran instead of Iraq, as you might expect. The Elamites had carried them off to Susa as spoils of war. This is kind of ironic, since it was King Hammurabi himself who had brought Susa under Babylonian control once again. Not content to take Hammurabi's famous law code as a trophy, the Elamites also snatched away the statue of Babylon's patron god, Marduk, probably conflated with the deity itself. Marduk, however, would in time return to his city, after Susa would in turn be sacked, which, as you may recall, would enable Cyrus the Great to slander the Babylonian king Nabonidus for neglecting to shake Marduk's hand at a religious festival. So you have a unique ebb and flow dynamic going on here, with two civilizational centers taking turns to dominate the other. You rarely have that in world history, I think. But here, it happened again in later times, more than once. Just think of the Iran-Iraq War as a recent example. The region around Susa is now known as Khuzestan, or, as Saddam and other Iraqi nationalists would call it, Arabistan. This is like the open front door in the mountain fortress that's Iran. Just by looking at a map, you might predict that this would be the place where the powers of Mesopotamian plains and those of the Iranian plateau would clash repeatedly. If someone were looking to prove that geography determines history, here's a case for you to point to. Since Susa was very close to Mesopotamia and subjugated to it during long periods, it was only to be expected that influences from the fertile plains would seep in. And that indeed that was the case. The pantheon of gods, for instance, was mostly Mesopotamian in origin. Now, just like the Achaemenids would later pay their respects to the gods of places like Babylon, so too the old Elamites wouldn't impose their gods on Susiana. Nor did the Elamites fold their language on Susa. On the contrary, it was cuneiform writing that spread east into Iran. In the so-called Middle Elamite period, it would be another story, however. Especially in the Late Bronze Age, when Susiana was strongly under Elamite influence. The title King of Anshan and of Susa then once again came in use. Slowly but surely, the Akkadian language then went out of use, and so did Mesopotamian gods, as Elamite deities would take their place in the pantheon. There were exceptions, though, the most important being Inshushinak, the patron deity of the city of Susa. He even remained a supreme deity for a long time, until finally being dethroned by his counterpart from Anshan. All said, he would be worshipped for over 2,000 years, which would make him one of the most enduring deities in world history. To be old was to be respectable, for it had proven itself. Inshushinak was associated with death. He gave life, protected it, and after he took it away eventually, he brought the deceased to the underworld. It would be known as the Weigher of Souls, some early form of the Last Judgment that would become so important in Christianity. The impressive ziggurats may also have had some function in kingly funerals. True, the actual tombs of the kings have never been found, but the obvious explanation for that is given to us by Ashurbanipal, the Assyrian king who sacked Susa, for he boasts of destroying these tombs and scattering the remains to the wind. In any case, even ordinary Elamites would bury their dead and give them useful things as offerings, which suggests, I suppose, that they were expected to use these in the afterlife. The richer the person, the more stuff that he got to take with him. This is quite different from the practices of the Zoroastrians, who would leave their dead in so-called towers of silence to be devoured by birds of prey, after which they cast the bones into a pit so as not to pollute the earth. Centuries would still have to pass before such habits would be established, however. Cyrus the Great still had a tomb, and under Darius, that great fan of Ahura Mazda, Elamite gods may even have made a revival. It's clear that the Achaemenids, and through them many others, borrowed enthusiastically from Elamite culture. Darius the Great built his palace on the remains of that of the kings of Elam, for instance. His famous inscription at Behistun is written in three languages, including Elamite. One of the main religious sites of the Elamites was located at Naqsh-e-Rostam. On that very same spot, the tombs of four Achaemenid kings are located. Even Sasanian kings would scratch their giant inscriptions in that rock facade. So this site, closely associated with Elamite cults, would remain important for thousands of years after they were gone. Although Elam eventually became a province of the Persian Empire, its legacy continued to inspire awe. A bit like the Romans who absorbed Greek culture after they conquered Greece. Among other things, Elamite building techniques and kingly titles would remain in vogue. And when the Achaemenid king entered Babylon in triumph, he would wear Elamite-style robes of state, a clear sign of how he wanted to be seen as a successor to the Elamite kings. The Babylonians, I suppose, had no choice but to suck it up, but they may have found this strange, given that Cyrus was supposedly sent by their god Marduk. They may have wondered why this savior then dressed like the people who had carried this god off to Susa. One of the most enduring legacies of Elam, and no doubt the most controversial, are royal wedding practices. Now I have to make an admission here. When I was thinking about how to cover the Elamites, I was sure that I was going to talk about this salacious topic. As you know, I often listen to Dan Carlin, one of my heroes, and he mentions multiple times how Elamite kings were often insane. Alas, I looked for them, but I couldn't find any serious books that comment on this. And in any case, since we depend on Mesopotamian texts, the claim that the Elamite kings were all crazy would have had to have come from these arch enemies of theirs. Even if that were the case, we could hardly take it at face value then, I'm afraid. But that is not to say it would be that far-fetched. There is a reason why this may well have been the case. The Elamite royals had an appetite for incest like you wouldn't believe. Now, I am a bit queasy talking about this, but it's true that plenty of other royal houses married in the family too. Just think of the Habsburgs or the family of Alexander the Great. But still, I feel relatively confident that the Elamites took this to another level. For this is even confirmed more than once in the Encyclopedia Iranica, which is not exactly biased against Iranian culture, to say the least. For example, when the Encyclopedia Britannica would claim, wrongly, that Elamite influence on the wider region was almost non-existent, the Encyclopedia Iranica would say that it spread over a huge area from its earliest beginnings. Perhaps also a little bit chauvinistically, I don't know. But my point is, you wouldn't expect this source to defame Elamite culture for no good reason. Apparently, the common title of the Elamite kings was Son of the Sister. Now this was wrongly believed to mean nephew or something. In the Encyclopedia Britannica, it says that it means that the Elamites had a unique matrilinear system of succession. However, what this title, Son of the Sister, actually means is that the prince in question was the child of the king and his own full sister. And because of that, he had more legitimacy than, for instance, a child that the king made with a foreign princess. In fact, according to the Encyclopedia Iranica, quote, the supreme degree of legitimacy was accorded to the son born to a union of the king with his own daughter, unquote. Which I suppose almost everyone today would consider even worse, no? Now, I'm not a specialist by any means, but I tend to think that if you have such inbreeding, generation upon generation, then this would have to cause genetic problems sooner or later. And it might indeed become a flip of the coin whether the next in line will be a mad king or not. So although we can't say anything with any confidence about the character of any one Elamite king, I wouldn't be surprised if some behaved rather erratically. More importantly, later dynasties would follow this example. We've already seen that the Achaemenid kings also married their sisters. I mentioned at the time that this would only be possible if there was no existing taboo against incest. Now, the Persians originally came from Central Asia, where endogamy is not so common. Although it's hard to generalize, nomads usually exchanged women or boys with other tribes. But once they settled in Anshan, their cultural examples became the Elamites. So it seems likely to me that this idea that marriages within the close family were better, that came from the Elamites too. And as we've seen later on, this idea would even seep into the Zoroastrian religion in Sasanian times, which would mean that the practice would not stay limited to the royal house, but trickle down to broader classes of society. Something else that the Elamites would have in common with almost all later Iranian empires was that they understood the importance of trade. They would have been blind not to. Iran lies in between the Fertile Crescent and India, so it is ideally placed to take advantage of the exchange of goods between these centers. During the Bronze Age, Elam profited mightily from this trade. Also, they controlled the access to vital resources that were lacking in Mesopotamia, like wood, stone, and perhaps most of all, tin. The latter was so important because it is necessary to make bronze, which was quite important in a period called the Bronze Age. This partly explains the power of Elam, but also why Mesopotamian powers kept marching on the Iranian plateau. Tin was to the stage of the Bronze Age what oil is to those of our own time. After the Bronze Age collapsed, you have the Iron Age, of course. Now, it's a common misconception that iron is stronger than bronze or something. In fact, the main thing that is better about iron is it can be readily produced almost anywhere, since iron ore can be found in many places. The main reason why it wasn't widely used before is that it required a certain technology, closed ovens that can reach very high temperatures, much higher than needed for copper or tin, the key elements of bronze. The world's dependence on tin throughout the Bronze Age played into the cards of the Elamites. Bringing the crucial elements together meant trading through Iran. The uncontested hegemon of the Iron Age, however, would be the Assyrians, or rather the Neo-Assyrians. These are contenders for the title of most ruthless people that ever roamed the planet, and I am aware they would be up against some stiff competition. Concerned about the power and expansionism of the Assyrians, the Elamites formed a coalition with other big empires, but eventually they would be steamrolled by the Assyrian war machine, just like anyone else. The Assyrian king Ashurbanipal boasts how he utterly destroyed Susa in revenge. But while it would indeed never return to its former glory, he still exaggerated somewhat. For multiple Elamite kings ruling after the sack of Susa still left their inscriptions and buildings behind. But Susa would never return to its former glory. And this caused something the Assyrians did not intend. The Elamites, by hook or by crook, had long managed to shield Mesopotamia from a menace that was ever present in the center of Eurasia, horse nomads. Well, shielded to some degree anyway, it's not that borders were impenetrable or anything. But now that Elam was no longer a power to be reckoned with, the threat from the horsemen became more acute than ever. Now, that is perhaps an old-fashioned way of looking at it. In reality, it was perhaps more the other way round. Centuries before the sack of Susa, in the beginning of the first millennium BCE, something happened in the dark center of the Asian continent. And whatever it was, it caused mass migrations. As a consequence, many tribal peoples settled in what is now Iran. Medes, Sogdians, Bactrians, Parthians, and many others. It is likely that these migrations so fatally weakened Elam that this is what allowed the Assyrians to crush this old enemy of theirs eventually. But by then, Elamite territory had probably been reduced to little more than the region around Susa. Ashurbanipal boasts how he laid waste to the land of Elam, but the most important part he hadn't destroyed at all. It was now under the sway of the new migrants, now known as the Persians, and they absorbed much of its culture. The Persians, I imagine, felt about the Elamites a bit like the Franks would feel about the old Roman Empire. They had a more rudimentary culture and looked with awe to what this ancient civilization had accomplished over the millennia. They wanted some of that splendor, that prestige, and so they began to regard and present themselves as Elam's successors, a bit like Charlemagne wanted to become a Roman emperor. For the time being, however, the new kings of Anshan, the family of Cyrus, was still subjected to another tribal group, the Medes. They had settled further north and established their capital in Ecbatana, now Hamadan. That was a rougher neighborhood, further away from the old Elamite centers, and consequently, the Medes stayed closer to their nomadic tribal roots. They were all the more dangerous for it, as the Assyrians would soon discover. For together with the Babylonians, the Medes would take down the great hegemon of the Iron Age and sack its capital. A generation later, however, the Persians would take over the Median Empire, as we saw last episode. So once again, a people from Anshan would get to rule the region of Iran and many other places this time. Now, this is not entirely coincidental. Susa and Anshan, the two main centers of the Elamite empires, are among the few places in Iran that are really favorable to agriculture. In the hot valleys of Iran, moisture tends to evaporate. In mountainous areas, farming is only possible on the foothills by draining water from the mountains through intricate irrigation systems known as kanats. These are, in essence, underground aqueducts, tunnels that lead water from the mother source through the mountain towards the village cistern. To dig these tunnels and keep them in good working order, you had to dig pits that are tens of meters deep, which look like giant molehills. This technique would spread far and wide, and it is still in use today, by the way. There are about 1,000 functioning kanats left, and the longest is 8 kilometers long, can you imagine? This speaks to the ingenuity of the system, but it has its limitations. The water supply was steady but limited, just enough for a small population. Therefore, a pattern would emerge of isolated villages that each produce relatively little surplus for elites to exploit. Besides, if you want to build and maintain a multi-kilometer canal system, everyone needs to do his part, I guess. Cooperation is vital. So the demands of the soil kept the villages egalitarian as well as autonomous communities. The downside to this was that there was hardly any room for specialization, including of the military kind. And neither could the villagers join forces with other towns because of the distance, the lack of roads, and the bad terrain. And that meant that they were pretty vulnerable to people who did not have these limitations. Alas for them, there were such people in Iran, and these were called nomads. By definition, nomads are mobile, and through trade and plunder, they can gather enough riches to fund entire armies. Villages were no match for these bands of nomads. And if they didn't want to be sacked, they had to pay for protection, an arrangement that could easily evolve into permanent political dominance. It is no coincidence, then, that most of the Persian rulers that we've encountered were nomadic in origin. The Medes, the Achaemenids, the Parthians, the black and white sheep, the Safavids, the Qajars. This also explains why a people like the Achaemenids still taught their boys to write, shoot, and speak the truth, all archetypal step virtues. It helped explain why their court kept moving, why they kept wearing pants in a time that few others did, why nobles, even under the Sasanians, took pride in keeping their oaths and in their hunting skills. The Persian rulers, in effect, institutionalized the typical power relation between the nomad and the village dweller. Once the Persians ruled true empires, this also determined the relationship with their subject peoples. Like nomads that tended to look down on settled folks, so too the Persians came to regard themselves as a superior people ruling over others. This sounds banal, but the Persians were actually the first to stress the diversity of their subjects in their propaganda. The Assyrians didn't do that. They wanted to stamp out their subjects' separate identities, so as to eliminate their will to secede. Like a nomad band asking money as gratitude for protection, the Persians kept alive a fiction that they were just rulers over lesser peoples. I came to protect you and your gods, so you should now pay me tribute. Strange as it sounds, that was probably an improvement on common practices. The Assyrian statements were more like, either you submit to me unconditionally, or I will kill every human and animal, burn your cities to the ground, destroy the statues of your gods and the graves of your ancestors, and even pour salt into the earth so that nothing will ever grow there again. And if needed, they did just that. Now, if they forced me to pick one of these people as my rulers, I think I would opt for the one that at least pretends to act in my interests. And it seems that many people who had suffered under the Assyrian and Babylonian yoke felt the same way. Perhaps it's not even entirely coincidental that it was a Persian who came up with this new approach to propaganda, conquest through leniency and tolerance. Not only does that fit the idea of a benign protector, it's also well suited for a land with hard-to-reach enclaves. The Iranian terrain lends itself badly to forced centralization. Mountains form a natural barrier for faraway villages and regions, and the numerous nomads were uncontrollable by their very nature. So for a state, it's better to look for an agreement through a combination of false reward, threat, and only in the case of need, exemplary punishment. This attitude was even reflected in the structure of cities once these began to develop. The rulers built a citadel for themselves, shielding themselves from the masses. That shows their sense of superiority, but it also betrays their insecurity. They remained dependent on artisans and traders who clocked together in the bazaar so that they could create a political front to lobby or pressure the rulers. The merchants and guilds kept doing that until the Islamic Revolution, when the rulers got their hands on independent sources of wealth, especially oil. The ancient Iranian city also stayed dependent on surrounding villages for basic goods. These could not defend themselves militarily, but in case of serious disputes, they sometimes just left collectively, an extreme form of going on strike. So the ruling warrior class was well advised to be reticent in their demands and to avoid being seen as oppressive. This in turn, I think, spilled over into the official political theory. For Shah, after all, means he who is king by his own merit, suggesting that if these merits aren't good enough, his divine aura might leave him. This mysterious force, the Far, would then temporarily hide in a deep lake like the seat of Zarathustra until a new just ruler would emerge. This concept would stay popular at least until the Sasanian era, soon to be supplanted by a belief in another hidden just ruler, the Imam. Or am I seeing ghosts here? Anyway, I think it shows that in Iran at least, the concept of the Eastern despot is unfounded, at least until recently. Until well into the modern era, villages, nomads, and even city communities retained much of their autonomy, despite the grandiose claims of absolute authority of their rulers. At the end of the 19th century, for instance, the Qajar Shahs, theoretically, appointed all-important officials. In practice, however, they simply selected a candidate who was acceptable to the local population. Only when infrastructure improved dramatically, when oil income paid for a strong army and bureaucracy, only then could the state afford to become more dictatorial. Only then the limits of the Iranian geography could be overcome. Perhaps it's not so strange, then, that the Iranian people still find such value in freedom, autonomy, and democracy. So, here we are, the end of our trip through Iranian history. It saddens me somewhat, because it is one of my favorite topics, but let's be honest, this series has taken long enough, longer than I envisioned. Since I intend to come to the rest of Asia at some point, it's time to move on. Next time, we will talk about... No, I'm not going to spoil it yet. Let's just say, not a typical tourist destination. I will have to catch up about the latest events there, however. The world hasn't been standing still. Therefore, it will probably take a little longer before the next episode comes out. So best follow the podcast on Spotify, then you get notified when it comes out. Hopefully, until then. Bye!